Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On election night, Republicans took it all, and that includes the majority of members of the North Carolina congressional delegation. Today, there are 7 Democrats and 7 Republicans in that delegation, but in January, that will change to a 10-4 split with Republicans in the majority, largely due to redistricting performed by a Republican-controlled General Assembly. Nevertheless, it changes the dynamic, and it adds to GOP control of the House of Representatives. The election will also bring a lot of new faces to Washington, not just because of the vote, but because of retirement or plans to run for a different office, and that includes people from both sides of the aisle. So in the current political environment, what, if anything, will this turnover mean for the state of the Congress, and what does a lack of seniority on Capitol Hill mean for our state's political power in D.C.? For answers to those and other questions, we welcome back 2 reporters who cover the Hill every single day. Danielle Battaglia is congressional correspondent for the Charlotte Observer and the Raleigh News and Observer, and Reuben Jones is Spectrum News One's Washington reporter covering North Carolina and national politics. Welcome back to you both. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Morning. Danielle, North Carolina has this habit of drawing districts to favor one party or the other. The Democrats did it when they were in power. The Republicans have been doing it ever since they've been in power. And when the Republicans have been doing it, they've been making trips to court to over their artwork being rejected by the courts. And that's what's happened in this last several cycles. But they didn't create this current 7-7 split. So remind us how we got to the 7-7 split and why it's now going to be 10-4.
So the courts had determined that the state lawmakers had politically gerrymandered some of the districts. And so they had a special master come in and draw the districts and create this 7-7 split, which fantastic to cover. I really love covering a 7-7 split. But they were given permission to redraw the districts once we got through the 2022 election. And so they last, I believe, October, redrew the districts to favor Republicans again. I also forgot at one point the courts also flipped the control to the Republicans. And at that point, they threw out the response. It has been so confusing to follow all of these different layers because it happens so often.
But in a word, it's politics.
It's politics. Yeah. So when they redrew it, they tried to give themselves 11 districts to Republicans, 3 to Democrats. Don Davis, who is the Democrat from the 1st Congressional District, was able to hold on to his seat in the 1st Congressional District, and that got them to 10-4.
So when we got to the 7-7 split, Reuben, some people alleged that that more accurately represents the state and our political split among voters, that we're kind of equally divided, at least until this last election, it seems to me, because the Republicans did win here by a significant margin. So perhaps the 10-4 split might more accurately represent us. What are people saying about that?
Yeah, I mean, it falls along political party lines again in terms of what people are saying, but it is true that North Carolina is pretty down the middle, 50-50, it leans Republican a little bit more, as we've seen the presidential results. But on a lot of these state races, Democrats did pretty well, governor, attorney general, see what happens on the state Supreme Court race. But look, I mean, gerrymandering, Democrats and Republicans have been guilty of in North Carolina, but also in states across the country. This is an issue that a lot of people don't fully understand, but I would argue is one of the biggest issues in politics today, because it has a lot of impact on who controls the House, and it has a big impact on what type of members go to Congress, because you often have to run in a primary, so you're forced to go more right or more left rather than run in a more centrist district where you're forced to go more in the middle.
Yeah, gerrymandering the primary system, the what's it called in the Senate, the where they have to have 60 votes, filibuster, the
filibuster,
all of those things essentially work against democracy. And there's an organization called the Gerrymandering Project, which does nonpartisan analysis to help us understand and eventually eliminate partisan gerrymandering state by state. They rate those states on how their state legislative and congressional maps are drawn. And they've given Virginia and Kentucky and Alabama, an A grade. But North and South Carolina, Tennessee, and Georgia were given an F. North Carolina's F was the result of the map giving both Republicans and incumbents a significant advantage for the, and for their lack of competitiveness, as was South Carolina. What they added in South Carolina, the racial makeup of how they drew their districts. And according to the Gerrymandering Project, 12 states get an F, 20 get an A, I think 24 get B's and C's, something like that. And although most of the D's and F's are in Republican-controlled state, not all of them are. Some of them are in Democratic-controlled states. So do you ever hear this being discussed, Danielle, in the halls of Congress? Do Congress people like, dislike, complain about, worry about because of the lack of democracy reflected in gerrymandering?
I don't know that worry about would be the right word. I mean, the system is set up to help maintain control of the various chambers. And so if anything, it's helpful to them. We have Representative Richard Hudson, who's chairman of the National Republican Congressional Committee. His entire job is to maintain control of the House for Republicans. And he never shied away from saying that North Carolina was one of the reasons that they were able to maintain control because they picked up so many seats here. And so I think for members of Congress, it's always seen as a positive, even though it's taking away the public's ability to decide who's representing them.
One of the Democratic lawmakers who is not running for real, did not run for re-election because his district became a lot more Republican, is Wiley Nickel in the Raleigh area. He has been a vocal opponent of gerrymandering and has talked about it. I believe he introduced legislation. And while he's talked about it, has not gotten any traction in Congress and is not likely to get any traction in Congress.
And of course, the reason that Jeff Jackson, a very prolific member of Congress, at least on social media, decided not to run again was because he was gerrymandered out of a district. He could not win in the newly drawn district, and so he will now become our attorney general. Democrats went from 7-7 to now it's 10-4. So we've lost three congressional seats if you're a Democrat in this election. Republicans have been and will continue to be in the majority in this Congress, this next Congress. Will the loss of Democrats, Reuben, from North Carolina have any meaningful impact on Congress or on our state's delegation, especially with GOP victories in both the House and the White House? In other words, does it matter that we have lost three Democrats?
Yeah, very much, because if those three Democrats were in Congress, there's a very good chance that the House could be controlled by Democrats in 2025. Yeah. Right now, it is going to be very, very tight for Republicans. So it is very significant on the national level. On the state level, it's sort of TBD. I mean, it is the relations between the Democrats and the Republicans is mostly pretty good, I think. Danielle, I don't know if I've asked some of the lawmakers about this in the past. I don't know of any regular group congressional meetings that happen between the lawmakers. I think that happens in some states, but I haven't heard about it on a bipartisan level in North Carolina. So there's some working together. You see legislation introduced by Republicans and Democrats in North Carolina. How much that is impacted by having more Republicans versus Democrats, kind of hard to say, but I'm sure the Democrats that are leaving Congress because their districts are more Republican would argue that their constituents are not as best represented as they were by when they were in Congress.
Of course, North Carolina is not the only state that gerrymanders, clearly. Almost all of them do in some way or another, and even though we have a Republican takeover of the Congress and the White House coming up in January, that's being viewed in some circles as a mandate. Maybe not. Maybe gerrymandering played a big role in that. But you recently spoke, Reuben, with Congressman-elect Tim Moore, who naturally agrees with that idea.
Our voters in North Carolina, though, I think have shown very solidly that they support President Trump and that they support the Republican brand and a good conservative agenda, not only for the U.S., but also for our state.
He's not the only one who sees this Republican takeover as a mandate, but as this vote count continues to trickle in the presidential race, it takes a while to count 155 million votes, you know. Donald Trump's lead over Kamala Harris is continuing to diminish. There's no question he won the Electoral College, so he's going back to the White House. But he has fallen below 50% of the popular vote as of Monday afternoon, and I think these numbers are still holding true. Trump was at 49.94%. while Harris was at 48.26%, according to the Cook Political Report's tracking of these results. He can no longer claim, he will, but he can no longer legitimately claim a powerful mandate that he's been bragging about. And if the vote holds, with Harris trailing him in the popular vote by less than 2%, 1.68% in fact, will that change anything? Will it give members of Congress something to think about before they go throwing all of their weight behind everything that President Trump wants to do, Ruben?
One of the challenges with how we count votes in many states is that it takes a while to fully get a grasp of how much someone has won or lost. The narrative has already been built in that this was sort of a landslide for Donald Trump. We're starting to see that it is tightening more and more as the more votes come in, especially from the state of California. It's why there are a number of House seats that are still yet to be declared a winner in California. So will the discussion of whether this was a landslide or whether this was a close election change in the coming weeks? We'll find out. I almost guarantee you that will not change from the voice of Donald Trump or the Trump administration, and they will see this as a full embrace of the Trump administration. And we've seen that in his picks for his cabinet secretaries.
Well, that's what I'm getting at. I mean, he's picked some people that are unorthodox, to use a nice word, for some of these positions. And many say that some of the people that he's chosen have absolutely no experience and therefore no business being there, but that those are his choices, and he wants to shake things up. That's what he sees his mandate as being, an opportunity to shake things up. But these members of Congress that have to say yes or no to these appointments are up for re-election in 2 years. And if this mandate is diminishing in size, will they be more circumspect? Will they be looking over their shoulders, Danielle?
I think there's several different layers that go into this. And I think watching our two senators will be very interesting because we have Senator Ted Budd, who tends to fall more in line with the president, president-elect Donald Trump. And you have Senator Tillis, who tends to work across the aisle. And I'm not sure I would call him a moderate, but tends to be more moderate than Budd. And so he is facing a re-election in 2026. It's already supposed to be an intense re-election, a very expensive one. It's a midterm election with a Republican president, and he's a Republican, so it's going to be very difficult for him. And I think he's got to weigh both what his constituents want, what he, what would get him re-elected, but also looking at that, you know, Trump demands loyalty from the people around him and what that's going to do to his political career.
Of course, loyalty is largely dependent, I would think, on your being comfortably ensconced by the voters in your position of power, whatever that power position may be. And that power position appears to be diminishing by the hour as they count these votes. I'm going to come back and talk about that, talk about some of the new faces in the North Carolina delegation, how they got there and why, and what that will mean, because we now have less seniority in the House than we did prior to this election. Daniel Battaglia is with us from the News and Observer. Reuben Jones from Spectrum News One. We're coming right back. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with Danielle Battaglia, congressional correspondent for the Charlotte Observer and the Raleigh News and Observer, and Reuben Jones, the most hydrated reporter on Capitol Hill. He's the Washington reporter for Spectrum News One. You just took a sip out of the biggest glass I've ever seen. I'm assuming that's water.
No comment on that, but if I don't have a big one, otherwise I never drink. So
okay. So if this vote count in the presidential race continues, Donald Trump will win a lower percentage of the popular vote this year than Joe Biden did in 2020, or Obama in 2012, or 2008, or George W. Bush, or George H.W. Bush, or Ronald Reagan. And Kamala Harris will walk away with a higher percentage of the popular vote than Trump did in 2016, Bush in 2000, Clinton in 92, or Nixon in 68. Republicans have big plans. If the Congress acts as a rubber stamp for the Trump administration, they will reshape the government in some unrecognizable ways. And once they analyze these presidential numbers, this is a new way to rephrase this question. Might there be some sort of a backlash, some sort of a concern about a backlash? Or, in politicians' minds, is a victory just a victory and I'm going to do what I want? Reuben.
I remind people that this Senate, this House, is dramatically different than 2017 when Donald Trump first entered the White House. At that time, there were a lot of skeptical Republicans who weren't really on the Trump bandwagon. Well, you fast forward to today, it is dramatically different. The folks who weren't on board have either left Congress or they've gotten on board. And so it is very hard to find skeptical Republicans in the Senate or the House of Donald Trump, even if the results are close. And so I'm not so optimistic if you're a Democrat that Republicans might be pushing back on some of what Donald Trump is doing. The people to follow, I think, in the Senate are Lisa Murkowski, Susan Collins, Tom Tillis, potentially Mitch McConnell, in terms of people that might push back on some of the cabinet picks and things like that Trump has put forward.
But not John Thune.
John Thune is a traditionalist Republican who falls in line with what Mitch McConnell has. He's an ally of him. So he may do some pushback, yes. Definitely more than if Florida Senator Rick Scott had been chosen, I think.
Danielle.
I also think it's important to know that Donald Trump is one of those people who subscribes to, if you say something enough, it becomes true. And he had the biggest crowd of any inauguration ever. We heard that from his team over and over. So I'm sure we're going to hear he had the largest popular vote of any president ever, over and over, until everybody believes it. I mean, that's just kind of the school that he comes from, even if it's not real. No. And so,
that's why I brought it up. That's why I brought it up, because he lies every time he opens his mouth, and people need to know the truth. Danielle, as I mentioned, we have a lot of new faces in this delegation. How many newcomers will we have in the North Carolina congressional delegation this time around?
We have five, but in my head it's four, because it's like the Snow White Seven Dwarfs theory, where you always forget the seventh dwarf and can't name them, but it is definitely five.
I can't name them either.
I was trying to do it yesterday, and I always forget one.
One powerful member of our current legislative delegation and of Congress at large is Patrick McHenry. He most likely would have become the Speaker of the House, but he decided to leave Congress instead. When you couple his departure, Reuben, with those of others, what does the diminishment of seniority mean for our state's ability to influence policy in Washington?
Yeah, Danielle and I were talking about this a week or so ago, about how there is not as much power in the delegation that there was or is in this current Congress. Yes, you have Patrick McHenry leaving, who's probably one of the most influential members in the Republicans on the House. Richard Hudson is powerful, but he's powerful on the political side of things in terms of getting House Republicans elected. Virginia Fox is a senior Republican in the delegation, but she can no longer run as the chairwoman of the House Education and Workforce Committee. I think her term has expired there. Tom Tillis has some sway because he's a moderate. Deborah Ross had a leadership position in the Democrats this current Congress. I haven't heard whether she still has that yet. So, yeah, there's a diminishment of power. What does that mean? It doesn't help when it comes to getting money to specific projects in the state. It doesn't help with getting ranking positions, senior positions on committees. And it doesn't help with getting a voice with leadership, whether it's Republican or Democrat. So it is a significant development. And I will also say it's a bit surprising, I think, that given how much attention was put on North Carolina by the Trump campaign over the past 6 months, no one from North Carolina, at least of note, has been chosen for the cabinet or chosen for ranking positions. Will that change? It could, but as of now, no.
Yeah, I don't know how to ask this question, Danielle, but it seems to me that the Republicans in the House and Senate are a wholly owned subsidiary of Trump, Inc. So when it comes to local representation, clearly they're focused on getting the Trump agenda through the Congress, either as a rubber stamp or after some minor debate over it. But what will that mean since we're in the minority and don't have any senior? Well, since we don't have any seniority, what will that mean for this ability to get certain things through? For instance, in Charlotte, we have been toying with this transportation plan now for about a decade, and our opportunity to get federal funding for it at any meaningful level seemed, and I kept saying this over and over again, you have 4 years because the Biden administration is transportation friendly. Pete Buttigieg gets it. I'm not sure that the Trump administration is going to be so focused on trains and things that Charlotte says it needs. So what will this do for our ability to get funding for those projects?
I mean, yet to be seen, but I do have concerns going into this administration on the local level and what we will see move, because a lot of the focus seems to be on retribution, immigration, abortion, trying to think what all we've talked about, healthcare, and not so much on those issues that really affect people back home. And so when you've got people fighting that aren't, you know, going back to Patrick McHenry, he had the speaker's ear, he could get things accomplished and get things done. Now we're in a situation where we're trying to fall in line with a president who has an entirely different focus. I think it will be difficult to have those conversations and get things accomplished that fall outside of what the president wants.
When it became apparent that a lot of the old timers in our House delegation would not be running for re-election, WRAL television proclaimed that, quote, North Carolina would be losing influence in national politics. Is that what this means? How much national influence, Ruben, did we have?
Well, I guess I would just remind people that, yes, the North Carolina is losing a lot of members, but the only one of those members that had seniority is Patrick McHenry. The rest were relatively new to Congress, either freshmen or sophomores, I believe. So I don't want to overstate the loss, but Patrick McHenry was a significant loss. The people coming in, it will be interesting to see how they approach things, because with the exception of Tim Moore, all the others are political outsiders. I've never held elected office from my count. Brad Knott is a federal prosecutor and a couple others outside positions. So, and I will also say that influence, especially in today's politics, is not always whose ear you have, but it's how loud your mouth is in the sense of, are you very vocal? Dan Bishop was a member of the House Freedom Caucus, and he often garnered attention, whether you agree with it or not, and would garner attention on social media because of sound bites he would mm-hmm. garner. So there's sort of different approaches for how you gain influence these days.
I was going to bring up Dan Bishop next, because Dan Bishop, as you said, is the member of the Freedom Caucus. He was probably the most conservative member of the state legislature when he was in that body. He was probably among the more conservative members of Congress as a member of the House of Representatives. On the other hand, Jeff Jackson, not exactly a raging liberal, but a moderate left-leaning moderate, I suppose, in the Democratic Party, and very well known because of his participation on social media. Neither of them will be in Congress next year because they both chose to run for Attorney General, a seat that obviously Jeff Jackson won. So they kind of balanced each other out, I guess, in Washington to a certain degree. But how will their absence be felt, Danielle, in this delegation, or will it not be felt?
I think there's been some frustration with, actually on both sides, people felt like Jeff Jackson, and I think this goes back throughout his political career, seeks attention and does things that they wouldn't necessarily do, which is funny because a lot of congressmen try to emulate his TikToks and things like that after the fact. I loved him for just basic explanatory videos that he could give the public to talk about what was going on in Congress. On the flip side of that, Congressman Bishop, he was outspoken. He was very vocal, caused a lot of trouble in Congress. And one of the things that I have said about the Republicans' power going into this session is, well, people think they can get more done because the Republicans controlling both chambers. A lot of what we saw that caused gridlock in this session was Republican on Republican fighting, and that had a lot to do with the Freedom Caucus. And so if they don't tamper that down, they might still show gridlock despite controlling both chambers.
Ruben, I suppose it's no surprise that all of the incumbents who chose to run for re-election in North Carolina won re-election, and that includes the very conservative Virginia Fox in District 5 and the left-of-center Democrat Alma Adams in District 12. Are they the two members of this delegation who are the most to the left and right, or are there others who may be in more in one direction or the other?
Yeah, I'm not sure I would say that for sure. I mean, and sometimes it depends on the issue. I mean, Congresswoman Valerie Fouché, Congresswoman Deborah Ross represent very Democratic districts. Congressman Greg Murphy represents a pretty Republican. They all really represent either Republican or Democratic districts, with the exception of Congressman Don Davis. So maybe Danielle has thoughts on it. I don't know who would be considered the most right or most left of the delegation currently.
Yeah, I think with the exits we're seeing, I'm not sure I could put a label on that either. I think you kind of nailed it on that. It depends on the issue and where we are.
The four Democrats, Danielle, in this delegation were all incumbents. Don Davis, Deborah Ross, I think Don Davis was an incumbent, yes. Valerie Fouché and Alma Adams. How do you see them approaching their jobs in this new Congress as both a minority in our delegation and as Democrats being in the minority in the Congress itself?
I mean, all of them are very strong individuals who don't back down from a challenge. So I think we're going to see the same level of pushing for what their constituents need. They obviously do have the problem that they're not in the majority. And so they're going to have to push harder. But like, that's where we've been before. They were there this session. They're going to be there now. I think, they know what their constituents want and what they need. And I think they're going to keep pushing for that. But there's that challenge of trying to get things passed and accomplished when they're up against the Trump machine.
And something Deborah Ross has reminded me that, she's worked with many of these members before in the General Assembly. The difference now is, again, a lot of the members coming in do not have that experience. So some of these folks have never met, and they're in the process of sort of having the orientation and the awkward first small talk meeting, and whether that blossoms into something more. Sometimes you get surprising friendships up here in Congress, and other times you get not surprising enemies.
Talk to me about that for a second. I wasn't going to talk about this, but this is interesting. We have a lot of newcomers in our delegation. I'm sure there are newcomers in every delegation around the country that are going to Washington in January. These are people, some of whom have no legislative experience whatsoever. Others were in their state legislatures, as you pointed out, so they understand fundamentally how it all works. But Congress is a different beast. Once you find the restroom in your office, you got a lot of other things to learn as well. How does that go? How do they learn these things? Do most of them sit back and watch in their first year, or do they dive headfirst in?
Yeah, I mean, so there is a orientation process that is underway right now. It is very similar to if you had freshman orientation going to college or going to high school. They sit in these auditoriums and they learn about all the inner workings. You know, yes, they are a lawmaker and a legislator, but they are also a CEO because these house offices hire 18 people. People staffed here in DC, people staffed in their district office. They have to open a district office. Tomorrow, they're going to get their house, their office assignments in what building they will be. Yes, that sounds minor, but I can tell you there are some pretty outdated, kind of disgusting offices in the House of Representatives with mouse traps and things like that. And they're very small. Some are nice.
Far away.
Yes, and far away. And then it's the process of getting to know people. And during orientation, I can tell you the freshmen, they get to know each other pretty well, the Democrats and the Republicans. And then it's a matter of forming friendships and figuring out, am I going to stay along and continue that friendship with the people I've met? Or am I going to be an outsider, be very vocal, try and get a lot of media attention and things like that? And they all take different approaches.
Mark Harris, let's talk about him for a second, because he ran for Congress once before and pulled himself out of the race after an election fraud scandal orchestrated on behalf of his campaign. But now he's going back. He's won in the newly created 8th District, and he won by a substantial margin over his Democratic challenger. Where does he fall on the sliding scale of conservative to liberal to ultra-conservative? He's certainly not liberal. And how will he be able to influence what our delegation tries to accomplish? I'm not sure which one of you wants to answer that.
I feel like he's nodding to me. I believe he's further conservative, but I don't know that I know that because I wasn't covering him the first time around and he didn't have much of a race this time to really follow. But I mean, he was fully supported by the Republican Party the first round and now again. You know, he's walking into this pretty...
Yeah. I mean, I covered his race against Dan McCready in back in whenever that was. And I think he's going to be pretty solidly conservative and follow party line with what the Republicans will do. But I never guarantee what somebody's going to do before the votes even happen. So he could surprise us. I've got an interview with him coming up pretty soon, so maybe we'll get a little bit more clarity, but it'll be interesting to see.
Get him on the phone. For the rest of the show, get him on the phone. We have to take a break. When we come back, we'll clean up a little more of the House and then we'll move our attention to the United States Senate. No big changes there for us because Tom Tillis and Ted Budd didn't run this time around. But Tom Tillis is up in 2 years, so we'll talk about that and more when we come back. It's Charlotte Talks. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the shakeup in the new North Carolina delegation that comes to Congress in January because of the recent election with Danielle Battaglia, congressional correspondent for the Charlotte Observer and the Raleigh News and Observer, and Reuben Jones, Washington reporter on North Carolina and national politics for Spectrum News One. Republican Speaker of the North Carolina House, Tim Moore, will be leaving that body to become the congressman from the 14th district. Danielle, did he walk away from real power in the North Carolina House to become one of many in a delegation of congressmen from North Carolina?
I'm fascinated to watch his trajectory because, yes, he did walk. I mean, he was the head of the House. It's a very powerful position in North Carolina. I believe he's third in line to the gubernatorialship, however you say that. And he's going to be one of, I think the number's 435. He's a freshman. He will have very little power going into Congress this year. You can rise very quickly in the ranks. We've seen, I mean, Chuck Edwards has gotten pretty high up for himself very quickly. But I'm really fascinated to watch how Tim Moore handles this transition because he is going to have such, like, despite being a congressman, it comes with a lot less power and a lot less ability to get things done.
And going back, Ruben, to your conversation with Tim Moore recently and his assertion that the people of North Carolina prefer Republicans, one echoed, of course, by Richard Hudson, Representative Richard Hudson, it is interesting to note that congressional districts were gerrymandered to favor Republicans, but in the only toss-up race in this recent election for Congress, a Democrat, Representative Don Davis, won re-election. Is that due to incumbency, or does it call into question that North Carolina voters have a preference for the GOP?
Yeah, I mean, I think that race has a few unique aspects to it. Yes, it helps that he's an incumbent. I was in that district about a month before the election and talked to a lot of voters. I think people like Don Davis quite a bit as a person who get to know him. I mean, I can tell you just having spoken with him numerous times, he's a very outgoing, friendly person. So that goes over well in the campaigning side of it. But also, I think it falls a lot to his voting record. He's probably one of the most moderate Democrats in the House of Representatives. He's bucked his party on issues of immigration and a number of things. And so he sided with Republicans. So I think during the campaign, Republicans got the opponent they were hoping for with Lori Buckout. They had a hard time kind of branding him as a unpopular Democrat because of some of the votes he had taken. So I think that helped him too. He also doesn't get very controversial during some of when he does talk during his interviews. He doesn't say too many things that would maybe raise eyebrows. Does that help? Perhaps. But I think Democrats are in a reflecting process right now, Mike, where they are trying to figure out, look at the Democrats that were in tight races. How did they win? People like Jared Golden in Maine and also on the state level, North Carolina for AG and not so much the governor's race because that was a little unique. But some of the others, what can they learn from them?
The Republicans will also take control of the Senate in January. No big changes in our delegation because neither of our senators were up for re-election. But we have two, both Republicans, Tom Tillis, who's the senior senator, and Ted Budd, who's the junior senator. Ted seems to be more to the right than Tillis. Tillis seems to be more of a pragmatic conservative. Is that just by comparison, Danielle, or are they both really more to the right?
So Tom Tillis once said, and it has stuck with me ever since, that you will see him more moderate during when he's not up for re-election because he likes to work across the aisle to get policy done.
He said that out loud?
He said it out loud on stage at UNC with Cal Cunningham, and it has stuck with me ever since.
And just his social media accounts from the past few months, and it is much more right than he was probably a year ago.
Yeah. Okay. So I'm like watching to see what he does in the next year and a half, because I think we're going to start seeing that transition further right. But yeah, he definitely talks about how this is a thing for him is he's elected to get policy done. And so when he's not up for re-election, he is trying to work across the aisle to get done the things that he thinks helps North Carolinians and the rest of the country. But when you get closer to the election, you're going to see him go further right.
And that's gotten him into trouble because he is known for working across the aisle with Democrats on certain issues. But it's a tightrope that he has to walk over top a horde of MAGA supporters who are ready to not catch him, but devour him if he falls. Last year, Republican delegates to the state convention, if we all remember, censured Tom Tillis for backing LGBTQ plus rights, immigration and gun violence policies. I believe it is accurate to say that Senator Tillis has also advocated recently for the Senate to see the House report on their investigation into former Florida Congressman Matt Gaetz, who's Trump's nominee to be Attorney General. And in a digital version of an article, Danielle, that you recently filed for the News and Observer, you included a back and forth with yourself and Senator Tillis and about his plan, with a question about his plan to vote in favor of the Gaetz nomination. Here's that exchange.
You're being misconstrued right now as saying that you may vote for him and confirm his nomination.
Well, that's because the press doesn't pay attention to what I said. Maybe if you record it, you can play this back verbatim. The president deserves to put forth a nominee. The president has an obligation to make sure that that nominee is going to pass vetting and have the votes on the floor. I will consider Matt Gaetz like I will anybody else, but if they don't do the homework, don't be surprised if they fail. Maybe they've already done that work. That's how this process works.
Were you surprised to see him as a nominee?
Nothing surprises me in politics. Nothing. And I'm okay with this. But at the end of the day, we have a process, and we'll just have to run through it. And I've seen you, Mr. Gaetz and I have sparred back and forth on social media. I don't care about that. I spar with these folks, and I still work with them. What I care about is a defensible resume and a really clean vetting. Produce that, he's got a chance. Don't, and he doesn't.
I wanted to play it because he said that we always get it wrong. So if you play it, you might get the quote right. Okay, so we did. So how should we review view this approach, Danielle, the fact that he's willing to say if Gaetz comes through and the report's not bad, he'll get the job. If he doesn't, he won't get the job. Is that him exhibiting himself as a man of principle or someone dooming his chances for election in 2026?
I would worry about the latter if I were him, just from the backlash I've seen on social media. I do like that social media keeps saying they censored him instead of censured him. I think if I know Tillis the way I think I do, I don't see him confirming Matt Gaetz if everything we're hearing is true about Matt Gaetz. I will push back a little bit. I don't think he is saying he wants the report out. I think he thinks it will come out no matter what, through leaks or through the Senate Judiciary Committee having it come out during the nomination process. But I think he is in a really tight spot right now where he has to decide what's best for the country versus what's best for his reelection. And there's already challenges on social media of who they're going to run against him in 2026 because they don't think he'll fall in line.
And correct me if I'm wrong, I believe Senator Tillis was one of the few senators to actually reveal their votes in the contest to succeed Mitch McConnell as majority leader. Senators John Thune, John Cornyn, and Rick Scott were in the running. Tillis, although he said he was going to vote for a guy named John, Tillis made the nominating speech for Cornyn, but Thune won. I suppose we can presume that he voted for Cornyn. Do we know how Ted Budd voted or even which way he leaned? Either
I've not heard anything.
They are not sharing that.
So if you choose the wrong horse in that race, Ruben, can it come back to bite you?
Well, it's a close vote, so Bud may have never told anyone who he was voting for, but if you're publicly saying it, I guess it could. I don't think it will for Tillis because, frankly, the difference between John Cornyn and John Thune is not significant. They are both relatively similar in the sense of we're involved in a lot of the bipartisan legislation from the past 2 years, both very conservative. The big difference was Rick Scott from Florida. He would have dramatically shaken up the Senate if he had been chosen.
NPR's Ron Elving, who covers politics, says that some of Trump's cabinet nominees will test the loyalty of GOP members of the Senate because of the firestorm of criticism that some of these people have elicited. Among the most controversial are Fox News Weekend Morning host Pete Hegseth. I'd never heard of him before this nomination, but he's been nominated to be Secretary of Defense because he was in the military for 5 minutes. And he's been questioned about his lack of experience, his comments about women in the military, and possible Christian nationalist leanings. Matt Gaetz is controversial as a pick for Attorney General for the reasons we've already mentioned. Representative Tulsi Gabbard is being picked for Director of National Intelligence. She has a reputation of being a defender of Vladimir Putin and having had dealings with Bashar al-Assad in Syria and has made negative comments about our alliance with NATO, all of which have raised grave concerns. So what if we heard, Ruben, about these nominees from Senator Tillis or from Senator Budd or Lindsey Graham or Tim Scott from South Carolina?
Well, it's one of the things that I fear is that a lot of the attention right now is on Matt Gaetz, which is rightly so. He has the current Health Ethics Committee and many other things. But there's a lot of other nominees to the cabinet that deserve the same amount of vetting as Matt Gaetz, and not only their personal record, but whether they have the work experience in the sense of for the position that they are lined up for. So Danielle can correct me, but I have not heard Ted Budd, and I'm not sure about Tom Tillis or even Lindsey Graham talk too much about some of the others. So my hope is that over the coming weeks, we're going to hear about some of these other nominees and get thoughts on that. The vetting process will play out. There are some concerns from Pete Hegseth. There's some reporting out there that he may be difficult getting him through, given some of his past history. Tulsi Gabbard is controversial, and a number of the others as well.
Are things relatively quiet in the Senate about these nominees because they haven't come before them yet, and so they're reserving comment until they do, or because they're going to rubber stamp whatever Donald Trump wants? Danielle?
I think Matt Gaetz honestly was so explosive to everyone that that's more why it's quiet, and that's one of the conspiracy theories going on, is that Matt Gaetz was pushed through as a way to make everyone else look more normal, and, you know, use up Trump's political capital on him. Actually, that would be the opposite of what I'm trying to say. But, you know, he's expending his political capital on Matt Gaetz. And so all the focus has been on Matt. And so nobody else is really coming top of mind. I mean, I was in the Capitol when the news broke that Gaetz got a nomination. And it was kind of chaotic there for a few minutes.
Here's something that might enhance Senator Tillis's bona fides as a Republican. He has warned his Senate Judiciary Committee colleagues that there would be consequences if they approved a Biden judicial nominee that he and Ted Budd are vehemently opposed to. The committee approved it anyway. Why this vehement opposition to this nominee for North Carolina Solicitor General Ryan Park to serve on the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals? Why the opposition? Anybody?
They feel he's very partisan. They think he's very partisan. They think he has fallen in line with his bosses in North Carolina. And they also don't feel like the White House respected the process of nominating somebody serious. One of the people that they had put forward, the White House had put forward, was Ted Budd's opponent, Sherry Beasley, who ran for the Senate. And so I think there's been a lot of frustration with them that they feel like they should have been more included. These are partisan picks. And as Tillis has said repeatedly, he's worked across the aisle to stop some nominations that other states didn't want, and he doesn't feel like he's getting that same respect.
Given the fact that Donald Trump appointed several Supreme Court justices who clearly are partisan, and Mitch McConnell blocked Obama's last appointment to the Supreme Court, and some of the nominees coming out of Mar-a-Lago for various cabinet positions, is that the smell of hypocrisy that I smell coming floating down from the north? Democrats are now in a minority in both of the houses. What, if anything, can they do now to stop whatever Trump wants to do? Anything that they believe is wrong or divisive or threatening to democracy? Because they made a big deal out about the threats to democracy that are posed by Donald Trump and what he intends to do, and they're being very quiet about it now. Ruben, what can they do? Why are they so quiet?
I think they're quiet because they're still trying to figure out what happened. You know, they're trying to figure out where do they go from here. What will be interesting to see, they've already chosen Hakeem Jeffries as the House Minority Leader, but more interesting will be who they choose as the next head of the Democratic National Committee. We know Jamie Harrison, who ran for Senate in South Carolina, will no longer be the head of that. Will they choose someone that will completely shake things up, a new generation for Democrats? Or will they go with someone a little bit more establishment? There's been a number of people who've thrown their hat into the ring, including former Maryland Governor Martin O'Malley and a number of other people. So that will be interesting to see. What influence do they have in Congress? It's going to be more of a megaphone versus legislation, and it's going to be a challenge. But I will just point out, the Republican majority is going to be very, very, very small. And so if they can convince, like we saw on the Republican side in the North Carolina General Assembly, if they can convince a couple Republicans to come over to their side, not necessarily flip party, but maybe on a couple votes, that could be convinced. That could be helpful for them.
We don't have any time left, but I know they're meeting today in Washington about enhancing FEMA money because FEMA is short on money after Helene and the governor is in Washington to be part of that conversation. Will we see more funding coming from Washington?
I hope so.
Yeah, I think probably there will be some new funding. What it looks like is TPD.
Reuben Jones is a Washington reporter, one of many, I guess, Washington reporters, reporting on North Carolina and national politics for Spectrum News One. Danielle Battaglia, congressional correspondent for the Charlotte Observer and the Raleigh News and Observer. Thank you both for the hour.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. The senior producers are Gabe Altieri and Sarah D'Elia. Our engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.